And that's some of the news for Tuesday, April 19th, 2022. The news is producer Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York City. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Thanks for listening.
Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio coming up here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. Today, we are continuing our series on the climate crisis and militarism. Now, to review, for the last militarism show, we interviewed John Pfeffer. He's director of foreign policy and focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. And we asked John, is the national security framework within which we operate a climate crisis multiplier? Or said differently, does our approach to national security exacerbate the climate crisis here in the United States? We also asked him these follow-up questions. Given the climate crisis, do we need a different security framework altogether? And if so, what does that look like for you? So when you get a chance, take a listen to that show with John Pfeffer.
Now, our purpose in asking those questions is to disrupt, if not to rebel altogether against, this national security state mantra that climate change is a national security threat or a threat multiplier. That mantra, that securitization framework, not only takes specific actors out of the equation, you know, the problem is climate change, not people, but it also sets us up for a dangerous militarized approach to climate change that feeds our fossil fuel burning Pentagon and military. Anyway, for today's show, we have Claire Nelson, CEO and ideation leader for the Futures Forum, a not-for-profit education and research practice established to improve long-range thinking and planning for the future. Claire is also a member of Women of Color Advancing Peace and Security and Conflict Transformation.
We posed the same questions to Claire that we posed to John Pfeffer. Here is how Claire answered our questions. Claire, as you know, climate change is often characterized as a threat multiplier, quote unquote. That's a mantra that seems to be repeated everywhere and by everyone, left, right, and center. And the effect of that has been to turn that idea into this unassailable, inevitable truth. And Elise and I are interested in flipping that script and asking this question to you. Is the national security framework within which we operate a climate crisis multiplier? Or said differently, does our approach to national security exacerbate our climate crisis?
That is a question I think certainly needs to be asked. And I'm going to come at it from the point of view of somebody from the Caribbean region who certainly, as a small island person, sees the climate threat in terms of the disappearing coastlines across the region, the ongoing and ever-threatening hurricanes and floods that are rampaging the Caribbean region from Guyana. And I'm focusing from Guyana, which is part of the Caribbean regional political systems, because as you know, there's geographic regionalism and then there is political regionalism, right? So when I speak to Caribbean, I'm talking about those countries that for the most part are part of the Caribbean community, which is a 15-member nation, because that is how the U.S. government certainly relates to the region. I would say the approach to national security for the Caribbean region would certainly seem to be exacerbating to some way our climate crisis. And I'm saying this because this find of Exxon in Guyana, right? Of the how many hundreds million barrels of oil, the Guyana shelf, et cetera, has sort of awakened the idea that America is now going to be in control of all the oil reserves that they need, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore, being in control of all the oil reserves they need and having a foreign policy still be bent around making sure that they have all the oil reserves they need, that they control the oil reserves that they need, it means that there's more funding being spent on those issues as opposed to funding being spent on shoring up Caribbean countries and Caribbean islands and shoring up ways in which we spend on security. And that for me is what I mean when I say I think it's exacerbating the crisis. How much you spend on something is how much importance you're putting on something, right? On the other hand, an exacerbate is quite a strong word because it means like it's making it worse, right? I'm not sure if it's making the climate crisis worse in terms of the actual, let's say, warming worse, but it's making the way in which the length of time in which we choose to move away from the things which we're doing and moving towards options, it's not shortening that and hastening that the way it should be shortened and hastened. And quite frankly, my understanding, and I would hesitate to say it's the gospel truth, but my understanding is that there's some things in agreement right now between Exxon as a company and Guyana as a host country in terms of the environmental management of the waste from all this gas, which certainly are going to exacerbate the health of the sea, which is of concern to many of us in Caribbean region. So the sea and how warm the sea is, how warm the Caribbean Sea is going to make it worse if indeed it is true that they are flaring gas more often than they should be flaring gas. And it means that our sea is being, and the water which is being used is returned to the sea warmer than it should be. It means that the impact of that, in terms of the scientific impact of those things on the way the sea itself operates as a system, as an ecosystem, is going to be impacted. And so the impact on Caribbean food, the impact on the way the spawning grounds, the impact on coral reefs will eventually be, you know, worsened because the sea is one system. My point is, it is not that we can have a direct thing and say, okay, because this is happening, it's going to increase the thing by 2%. Or 3%. It's not that kind of a direct mathematical equation model. This is what the arguments I make in my conversation about the need to have what they call temporal intelligence or a futures intelligence that allows us to look at second and third order impacts, which are not necessarily a linear link, sure, right? But we know there's a link. The fact is that one, Exxon is flaring gas in Caribbean Sea. We already have a sea that's dying in many ways. Therefore, if we're already facing infestation because the sea is too warm and all the islands on the North Coast, for example, Antigua, all these islands are infested with an overgrowth of blooms, right? It means we're going to see more of that. Now, the question is, the U.S. government has a relationship with Caribbean region where it is more or less understood that the U.S. government has hegemony over the sea, right? So one would have hoped that the national security agenda for the U.S. government would include, let us make sure that the Caribbean Sea is healthy so that people can have jobs, so that people can stay where they are, and we won't have this horde of savages leaving the Caribbean to come to America illegally because they don't have no jobs. But national security does not include a conversation on environmental security, and that is my contention. So is it a linear straight line argument? No, it is not. But it is certainly a circular argument. And given that most natural ecosystems are circular, life and death are circular, not straight lines necessarily, it means that there needs to be an approach to national security that allows people to see the connections and linkages between environmental security, right, and human security in Caribbean being equally as important to U.S. national security as controlling oil reserves.
You are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. We are speaking with Claire Nelson about national security and climate change. Claire is CEO and ideation leader for the Futures Forum. That's a nonprofit educational and research practice established to improve long-range thinking and planning for the future. So you've made a couple of super important points that I think are really worth underlining. One of them is, as I took you to be saying, this program of job development to try to prevent migration, even if it were to be successful, even if they created massive quantities of very high paying jobs, such that the Caribbean was an extremely economically attractive place to live and nobody wanted to migrate from there. If there's still environmental degradation happening in the region, then there's still a huge incentive to migrate away from the Caribbean. So even if they did this miracle economic development through whatever combination of industries, if you're degrading the environments in the region, you're still creating a huge migration incentive.
I don't think you can create a economical high-paying jobs in the region and destroy the environment at the same time. I don't see it possible because the region's environment, tourism, for example, and agriculture, tourism, first of all, is one of the major income earners of the region, right? As coastlines disappear, then what? Right now, for example, the fishing catches are lower. As that disappears, then what? Everybody's not going to be a programmer, right? And one of the most interesting things to me is when I had a conversation with State Department about their disaster response program and lifestyle, some of the program they were doing. And I said, well, we want to make sure that farming is included in this. We're not including farming. Well, how can you not include farming and farm support and food security as part of livelihoods in the Caribbean region, when most of our food is imported from overseas? We don't have no tourists, so no, we don't have no money to buy foreign food, but you're not including agriculture as part of your prosperity agenda. The prosperity agenda of the U.S. foreign policy pillar for U.S. foreign policy towards the Caribbean region is supposed to include, from my perspective, agriculture. That's why I put it in a document that I write, my organization writes, which is my other organization, Institute of Caribbean Studies. As diaspora organizers and advocates, we craft what we think U.S. foreign policy in the region ought to look like. And we think U.S. foreign policy in the region and the national security of America would be supported if they were to support food security in the region by supporting agriculture. It's part of America's national security to assume that we can feed ourselves. Why? Because what happens is that when you can't feed yourself, the fisher folk then turn into drug smugglers. Is that what they want?
Claire, this is an important point, because you're talking to people who understand what's happening. They understand that makes sense. Your argument makes sense. And they are choosing differently. In other words, you know, of course you should be focusing on agriculture, but they don't care. They don't care. And so it's a refusal to care that's deliberate. It's a deliberate policy not to do something. And that is how that deliberate policy is becoming part of the national security framework, right? Yeah, we know you're going to come on the boats and come over here. We know you're going to do that. And guess what we're going to do? We're going to shoot you because we're setting up our borders patrols now. We're militarizing our borders even more. So we understand what the stakes are. You can tell us till you're blue in the face. It doesn't matter. How do you then begin to address that intransigence and that intention to make you suffer?
I don't know if the intention is to make us suffer or that people are so much into groupthink. I think there's a groupthink in U.S. Foreign Policy and State Department and that group that even though what they try to include, let's say, diversity and bring in people who are, you know, from different backgrounds to be in State Department, it's like once you go, you just jump into groupthink. You have to, there needs to be, my opinion is that I think that I may have had maybe a tinge of whinge, a bit of impact because I refuse to take these things out of the paper that I write, right? The papers that my organization writes, right? And when we meet with the State Department, and we say, okay, what is your plan for the Caribbean region? And I'm putting back agriculture, right? And so, but why? Because food security, I want to ask about the maritime, quote-unquote, support that we need for the environmental management of the Caribbean Sea to come back to national security. Remember now that the Coast Guard, the U.S. Coast Guard and military, with the fight between Venezuela and Guyana, right, a borderline thing, and Venezuela at one point had brought out their boats to patrol this supposed war because Venezuela is saying that Exxon is drilling sideways into their reserves. So there's this brewing undercurrent of we don't know what is happening. And then Russia and China are in Venezuela shoring up stuff. So there we go again, right? Russia and China, because to me, they had this crushing, sanctions on Venezuela. The whole of that part of the Caribbean region, southern Caribbean region, has been destabilized to some extent. Venezuelan migrants have moved into Trinidad. There are a lot of no piracy. That quote unquote fisher folk from are afraid to go out and fish because they may be kidnapped. Poor people, right? So there's a lot of stuff happening down there which nobody talks about because, again, the Caribbean region, we don't have the kind of journalism. We don't have the kind of, these are very small societies and life is very cheap. Okay, so we don't have the kind of support system that are going to protect people who necessarily stick their head above the water and say, hey, you know, we're suffering here. This is what is happening. And so it's almost like all of this, because of the hunger for oil and tied to America's national security, hunger for oil, and we don't see the financing and put into alternative. Yes, they put some into it, but not at the level of, let's say, speed in which it should be put, and for the Caribbean region, especially the non-oil countries, to be coming up with ocean thermal energy or wind energy or solar energy or whatever in order to kick us off of this oil frenzy. It's not working.
Well, just it's fascinating how an ordinary Caribbean fisherman with a boat who's trying to make a living fishing can have his or her life completely disrupted and turned upside down by the global international need for oil. This Russia, China, United States,
that's right,
geopolitical competition for oil that cooks the planet and destroys the climate is touching down in the region that you're talking about in those kinds of ways. And you know, it's destroying the planet. It's also destroying individual lives in the process and livelihoods.
Yeah, I really feel as if to say that there needs to be a more honest conversation between the U.S. government, national security apparatus, and the Caribbean government's security apparatus, that it's not just about the drugs because this tends to focus on drugs, right? The conversation centers about we need to prevent more drugs coming in from, you know, coming to the Caribbean region. We guys need to be more, et cetera, et cetera. And so they support the Caribbean government to a limited extent with, you know, patrol boats for cocaine smuggling or whatever. But I don't really think, and this, I mean, I'm not an expert in this, but I don't really think that that even that is moving at the pace it needs to move, given the continued intake of guns into the Caribbean region.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. We've been speaking with Claire Nelson, CEO and ideation leader for the Futures Forum and member of Women of Color Advancing Peace, Security, and Conflict Transformation. Given the climate crisis, do we need a different security framework? And if so, what does that look like for you?
I definitely think that we need to come into a new 21st century version of what national security looks like for the United States of America. And climate security should be one of them. Climate security globally should be one of them, right? Because we know what the numbers are reputed to, what the numbers are going to look like if, in terms of refugees, around the world in different, displaced people internally in Africa, displaced people internally in Asia, all those low-lying countries, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, all these countries, low-lying countries, right? Guyana, low-lying countries, but they have a lot of land, thank God. Suriname has a lot of land, thank God, and they can move interior if they want. And even there's a conversation now that islands like Haiti, which are continuing, well, countries like Haiti, not island, need to be having conversations now about where we're going to move people to. I don't see any conversations about 2050, assuming the Caribbean has actually lost coastline, etc., for the smaller islands where the carrying capacity is very small, where when the saltwater table becomes such that the carrying capacity of the limestone wells in which they're gathering water for wells is no longer able because of the salinity. I'm not seeing in the Caribbean from the current perspective, I don't see no long-term scenario studies and foresight studies that look and say, okay, what if we had to move 100,000 people between three islands? Where would they go? So the national security framework has to include human security from the perspective of how is climate crisis going to affect people who may have to move because their jobs are decimated, their livelihoods are decimated, their regions no longer function, and there's going to be a whole bunch of refugees around the world. What does our national security as the United States government look like if we have too many hotspots around the world that our armies, as they currently are configured, are able to support? Because the more, who is going to win in all this are the arms dealers, right? Because they're going to be able to come together and say, well, we're going to flare up here, flare up there. So is national security tied to peacemaking, or is national security just about ensuring that if something flares up, we have the weaponry to be in control? So the security framework of the U.S. government should be, I would say, reshaped, reimagined to match the 21st century realities in which climate change is a planetary threat, and therefore the potential for global instability and total misery from all of us around the world is going to be very high unless U.S. national security takes this into account.
Claire, thank you so much for coming on our show and sharing your ideas around this. We appreciate having you here.
I thank you so much for having me. And certainly the conversation that has only just now started.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This has been WBAI New York, I'm Linda Perry. As we move through April, I want to take a moment to thank new WBAI buddies, new BAI buddies who joined WBAI during Women's History Month. Jane Gennaro from the Upper West Side says, thanks for the beautiful programming for Women's History Month. Lucia Calamnaro is also a new buddy. She's from Boston, Massachusetts. She says, I can't choose a favorite program. You're a treasure, WBAI. So grateful you are here. Thank you also to Michelle Babian from Yonkers, a new buddy whose message is peace with the earth. Victoria from Tarrytown appreciates all WBAI shows. Jean-Louis from Long Island loves Gary Null's show. Steve Stansel from Brooklyn, New York is now a buddy at $20 a month. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Sandra Lynn, who appreciates WBAI's new morning show, What's Going On? She's a new buddy, and so is Francois from Brooklyn. Also from Brooklyn, Ben Yee is a new BAI buddy. His favorite show is from Margaret Flowers, Clearing the Fog. Ellis Landy from the Bronx says she loves WBAI. She's a new WBAI buddy, and so is Sandra from Ringwood, New Jersey. Her favorite show is Code Pink Radio. Ken from Harlem is also a new WBAI buddy. He's contributing $50 a month. He's from Harlem. His favorite show is Imhotep Gary Bird's Radio GBE, Gloria J. Brown Marshall with Law of the Land, and other shows. He says there's so many he loves. Lloyd from Brooklyn is a new WBAI buddy. Thank you so much, Lloyd. Amma from Flushing is also a new buddy. Thank you. So is Thomasina in New Jersey, and Betty Garland, who likes Vantage Point and Mansion for a Rat. Thank you. Pedro Chinnery from Suffern, New York is also a new WBAI buddy, showing the reach of WBAI. He appreciates equal rights and justice. Lori from the Upper West Side likes building bridges. Mike from Brooklyn is a new buddy in the name of Con Sabor Latino. Brenda from Montclair, New Jersey appreciates any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Thanks also to John from Chicago, a $100 buddy. Thank you so much to all of our new WBAI buddies, our monthly contributors, large and small and large. We so appreciate you and your continued support. If you'd like to become a WBAI buddy, just go to our website, WBAI.org, and click Buddy, or call 212-209-2950. And remember to tell us what your favorite show is. I don't have time to list all the new buddies right here and right now, but know that we thank you. Thank you so very much for your support.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing.
Testing.
Tune in to an extended version of Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright. On Tuesday, April 19th from 9 to 11 p.m., we'll take part in the Charles Mingus Centennial Celebrations that mark the 100th birthday of the mighty jazz composer, bass virtuoso, and musical visionary. We'll be joined by Zach Kersimi, co-director of the Charles Mingus Institute, Boris Kozlov, bassist and longtime co-leader of the Charles Mingus Big Band and Charles Mingus Orchestra, and Mingus's youngest son, Eric Mingus, bass player and amazing vocalist.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Did the cats drink coffee?
Well, it's tuna fish ice cream as a side dish.
Wow.
Wow, yeah.
David Kenny of Everything Old is New Again every Sunday night at 10. Please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again, because everything old is new again. I like it.
The previous program was extended.